From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Control of the House and Senate are at stake next Tuesday, and new voting machines and procedures are creating the potential for chaos at the polls. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Dan Seligson, editor of electionline.org, which tracks election reform issues and has published an election preview focusing on potential trouble spots. Then we'll talk with two leaders of the NAACP, Reverend Nelson B. Rivers III and Marvin Doc Cheatham, who are trying to get out the vote and prepare for irregularities and intimidation at the polls. And we'll talk with saxophonist, clarinetist, and composer Don Byron. His new CD pays tribute to Junior Walker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're 6 days away from a high-stakes election in which control of the House and Senate are at stake. With new voting machines and new procedures in many places, some people are preparing for a meltdown in the voting process, while others are predicting only minor problems. My guest, Dan Seligson, is expecting something in between. Seligson is the editor of electionline.org, a nonpartisan and non-advocacy organization that tracks and analyzes election reform issues. They've published an election preview examining potential election day problems. I asked Seligson what problems he's expecting.
Well, I think we've got so many people who are going to be voting on voting machines for the first time that they haven't used before. We've got poll workers who may have used these machines and administered an election in the primary with a lot fewer people to deal with. The stakes are higher, the participation is going to be much greater, and the possibility of some kind of breakdown somewhere in the system when you have just this many new machines, this many new rules around the country, the probability is good that we're going to have problems.
Things were supposed to be better by now. We've had the experiences of 2000 and 2004. The Help America Vote Act has taken effect. So why are we having such problems when things were supposed to have improved by now?
Well, January 1st, 2006 was a big date in the Help America Vote Act. That was the date at which each state was supposed to have a statewide voter registration database completed. And that was a major endeavor. That took all of the local lists had to be combined into this state list that had to be interactive, real-time, et cetera, et cetera. This was a complicated undertaking. And then, in time for the first primary this year, states had to have new voting machines, most states had to have new voting machines that were accessible to people with disabilities. Most of the time, that would be a touchscreen machine like we see in Maryland. In some cases, it's called a hybrid machine, where you use sort of a touchscreen interface, and it prints out a paper ballot that's then scanned by this optical scanner. But each state had to have these things in place in time for this year. So what we've seen is a tremendous amount of change, a lot of voting machine purchases, a lot of new database troubles in some places where they're just kind of having growing pains. They haven't done anything of this scale before in elections. And then we have some new procedures around the country, voter ID, provisional voting, that kind of thing. So we have all these things combined this year in a high-stakes race. Things that we really didn't have in 2004, while we had a huge election, we had a great turnout, we had a very high-stakes election, we didn't have the level of change between 2000 and 2004 that we've had really between 2004 and this year.
One of the issues with electronic voting machines is there a way of accurately doing a recount? And that's why a lot of people insist that there should be voter-verified paper audit trails. What are those?
A voter-verified paper audit trail is essentially a slip of thermal paper that runs either to the right of or on top of a voting machine, an electronic voting machine. And it essentially shows the voter exactly what should be in the computer's memory. So once the two match up, when the voter sees that what's on the screen matches what's on the slip of paper, they finalize the ballot, they hit the cast vote button, and then that slip of paper is cut off, kept separately, and then the electronic vote is, of course, kept in the computer's memory. Now, after the election, in most states that require these paper trails, the paper is used in the event of a recount. We saw this in Ohio, where they audited results after the primary.
But in one county in Ohio, wasn't it found that 10% of these paper ballots were compromised or damaged or uncountable for some reason or another?
Yeah, see, there's the trouble. What happens is we had inexperienced poll workers load thermal paper in the wrong way. Now, if you've ever used a thermal fax machine, if you load thermal paper in the wrong way, you don't see anything. Then we had some that ripped. We had some that were inexplicably blank. So when they wanted to do an audit of these voter-verified paper audit trails after the election just to see how accurate they were and how they matched up with the machine totals, they found that 10% were uncounted. Now, flash forward to this election. Imagine we have a race that's decided by 100 votes. They need to recount using these voter-verified paper audit trails, and they lose 25,000 ballots.
Let me get to the Diebold voting machines. That's the brand that most people know because there's been so much controversy surrounding them, because the head of Diebold has been a Republican, has supported Republicans, and there's a lot of, well, why don't you describe what the concerns are around Diebold machines?
Well, the concerns started really before 2004, when computer scientists in California started to become concerned about how machines are certified, who's making them, whether the code that runs these machines has some kind of independent verification by computer scientists, whether the machines are hackable, that kind of thing. Diebold was steadfast in its defense of its machines, despite the criticism that was coming in from computer scientists and very reputable computer scientists. Then we had this incident in 2004 where Walden O'Dell, the former CEO of the company, wrote a letter to a fundraising letter where he said he was going to, quote, help deliver Ohio's electoral votes to President Bush. That's not a good idea for the head of a large a voting machine company to make a statement like that just before an election. And that while he's gone and the company has, you know, since enacted a policy that limits any political activity by people who work in its election division, that statement and people remember what Walden O'Dell said. They remember that every time they think of Diebold. And you know, I think that the company continues to be the focus when people say there's something wrong with electronic voting machines, that electronic voting machines are corrupt, that, you know, these companies are run by Republicans. This is because of what Walden O'Dell did in that letter.
Is there any evidence that the Diebold machines are any more or less prone to tampering, to hacking, than other brands?
I don't know if Diebold is more or less hackable than other brands. I do know that when experts in the field get a hold of a voting machine to see whether it's hackable, they seem to get Diebold machines more often than not. So we had this Princeton professor who came up to Capitol Hill, I think it was sometime in early October, and he essentially hacked into a voting machine at this hearing in about a minute. So it was a dramatic display of something that, you know, that could happen on election day. Now, Diebold officials would say no one would have enough access to this voting machine. Nobody would have, you know, the necessary time and the ability to do this. Plus, they use old software. It's an old machine. It can't happen in the real world. Well, I don't think that Diebold's defense has really moved many people at this point.
So you've painted a picture in which there are a lot of genuine concerns about how electronic voting machines are going to function and whether the final counts will be contested or not. Is there any system in place in any part of the country to really deal with the potential problems that may occur on Election Day this year?
Well, I think optical scan systems, which are going to be used in a lot of the country, really, I think that is the most prevalent form of voting. What it is it's a piece of paper where a voter either completes a line or circles a circle next to a candidate's name. These machines are paper, essentially. They're fed into these feeders at a polling place. If there's a stray mark or some other ballot-spoiling error on the ballot, it gets spit back out. The voter can get a new ballot and vote it correctly. After the election, you've got all your electronic total that came from the machine. And then if there's any dispute, you can hand count ballots. If a voter made some weird mark and it was rendered uncountable by the machine, if I put a big heart next to Kerry and a big X and sad face next to Bush, an election official could look at that and determine voter intent. Obviously, I meant to vote for Kerry. So these machines, I think, address a lot of the concerns. They're paper, that you can do an independent count. But what they don't do is allow people with disabilities the possibility of voting independently and secretly.
My guest is Dan Seligson, editor of electionline.org. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dan Seligson. He's the editor of electionline.org, and this is a nonpartisan, non-advocacy organization that tracks and analyzes election reform issues, and we're talking about potential trouble spots for this coming election. Now, there have been disputes over the registration process and, you know, who's eligible to vote. Have there been a lot of states that have been changing the process in the past couple of years?
Well, there have been some new requirements with registration as far as providing the last four digits of a social security number or a driver's license. But there have been also in Arizona, for example, the Proposition 200 was approved by voters 2 years ago. And what it requires is that voters show proof of citizenship when they register. Now, this is something that no other state in the country requires. You check off a box, and it's essentially it's a legal document, so you're liable, you know, if you lie about your citizenship status. But Arizona takes that extra step to make people show something when they register. In other states, there have been issues with matching. The way that these new registration databases work is that you have information about a voter that can then be compared to health records, to corrections records, that kind of thing. So, and driver's records. So there has been an issue about whether a perfect match needs to happen. In California, for example, they said that thousands of voters weren't achieving this perfect match, and that people were being knocked off the registration rolls unnecessarily, or essentially disenfranchised because the information didn't match up like it was supposed to.
Now, in 2004, Ohio was very controversial. And it remains controversial in some circles. Congressman John Conyers had issued a report, What Went Wrong in Ohio, examining problems with long lines, cutting back on the right to provisional ballots, cutting back on the right of citizens to register to vote, targeting minority and urban voters for legal challenges, as well as other problems and irregularities. And the Secretary of State, who oversees and certifies the election, Kenneth Blackwell, was in 2004 co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign. And this year, he remains Secretary of State, but is also running for governor. So, given the controversies surrounding what happened in 2004, what are we looking at now in Ohio this year?
Well, I think if Florida was the poster child for election dysfunction in 2000, I think Ohio has taken the tiara. Ohio is really the new ground zero for potential election problems, and I think the media will descend on that state. Poll watchers, organizations like Election Protection will be watching very closely. We'll be there as well to take a look at what's happening. There's a lot of things going on in Ohio. First of all, most of the state is using Diebold, I believe, TSX voting machines, which is a newer version of their touchscreen machine that's in Maryland. These machines have the paper trail. Again, we had problems with the recounting of paper trails in Cuyahoga County. We have the state's top election official, who is the arbiter of elections in the state, is now also a candidate. So he's sort of, I guess he would be considered then the man on trial as well as the judge. But that's not rare. That happens in a number of states. And then we have a lot of questions arising about what went wrong in 2004 and what's been done to fix it. I think there has been some effort to deal with this issue of machine allocation. There's been new formulas about how many voters are expected voters and how many machines you have to have per voter. One of the biggest problems in Ohio was that machines were allocated incorrectly. So there were huge lines, particularly in inner city precincts. And a number of voters just didn't have the time to stand there for 2 or 3 hours in the rain. I think it was a miserable day to stand there and wait to vote.
In the 2004 election, Ohio became known as the new Florida. Do you think in 2006 that another state will become known as the new Ohio? Are you expecting particular trouble in one state this time around?
Well, we selected 10 states to watch, the criteria being there was either something going on in election administration or the potential for difficulty. One of the states that I think is maybe being overlooked is Connecticut. Connecticut has three House races that are very competitive. I think that the Senate race between Ned Lamont and Joe Lieberman has become a lot less competitive in recent days. But the House races are very competitive. And potentially, if you've got three Republican incumbents who lose or get close to losing their seat, this could have a major impact on the election. The state is using lever machines. Lever machines are these old clunky metal units that have been in place in a number of states for 60, 70, I don't know how many years, but a long time. There's 25 jurisdictions, and this is cities, small towns, who are going to be using optical scan machines. But for the most part, most Connecticut voters will cast ballots on these lever machines, which in 2005, We had a federal agency, the Election Assistance Commission, write a memo saying we're essentially not compliant with federal law anymore. So we've got vast numbers of people voting on these machines that a federal agency have said essentially are not compliant. They don't have a paper record.
You're also monitoring Florida. You've talked a little bit about potential problems in Florida this time around. Are there other things that you're looking for in Florida?
Well, Florida made a change to its voter ID law that, while it seems subtle, could have an impact on some voters. What they did was they, previously in 2004, a voter needed to present a photo ID in order to cast a ballot. If they didn't have a photo ID, they would sign an affidavit, and then they would go vote a regular ballot. Now, the slight shift has been, if a voter is now lacking a photo ID, they cast a provisional ballot, which is different. That is then set aside, and their eligibility is determined later. The question is, with greater scrutiny on each of these ballots, is there a greater opportunity to cancel ballots, to challenge someone's identity, to essentially discard a ballot that should have been counted? The other issue in Florida were some very strict rules they passed on third-party organizations, be it labor unions, a group called ACORN, other organizations that run registration drives. And what Florida's law does is it imposes some pretty severe fines on these third-party organizations if they fail to return registration forms within 10 days. Now, the fines could get as high as $5,000 per form. And what happened was a judge said, well, that's pretty steep, and that's going to stop a number of these organizations from registering people and therefore stop some people from registering to vote. So there was an injunction against the law in August. But this could definitely come back. You know, I think it'll come back to the legislature and could be revisited next year.
I'm going to ask you a question that I can't imagine you can really answer, but that's not going to stop me. The question is, like, why is this happening? Why in the United States of America are we so worried about the election being accurate? I mean, I just don't remember in my lifetime. I know there's been corruption. I know there's been, you know, contested elections in various places, but there's never been anything quite like this for several elections in a row. What is going on?
It's a great question, and I think what's going on is there's a much greater emphasis on the administration of elections than there ever has been before. My organization, for example, we didn't exist in 1999. We started up after the 2000 election because of the number of problems that were found around the country. I think both political parties have learned that they need to pay attention to the process or they're going to lose. They're going to lose an election because they didn't know what the recount procedures are. They didn't know, you know, how to challenge voters effectively. They've both been studying this issue. And as the electorate has become more divided, and now we're really a 50-50 country, every race is high stakes, and you know, there's always the possibility of using the courts to your advantage in an election. Both sides seek advantage both before, during, and after an election. And voter ID is one of those issues where, you know, we've got Republicans saying there's something wrong with fraud in our election system, and we've got Democrats saying there's something wrong with lack of access in our election system. They collide right at voter ID. You know, this is the issue that both parties have consistently have disagreed on, because it really cuts to that integrity versus access to the system.
Do you have any advice to voters this year who feel that either they're being denied access to the voting polls, or they suspect that their vote won't be accurately counted, or they've noticed some other irregularity that makes them suspicious? What should they do?
Well, I think the first thing a voter should do, and they should start soon, is to verify their registration before the election. Just call up, or if the state or locality offers it, go check on the website whether they are, in fact, properly registered. If there's a problem with registration, there's not a lot of time to fix it, but it is worth checking right now. There's a website called canivote.org that offers sort of a one-stop service where voters can link to each state or locality and find out their registration status and other information like polling place information. That's sort of the first step. At the polling place, if a voter makes a mistake, they need to tell a poll worker. They need to get a new ballot. They don't need to be embarrassed. Machines are new and the processes are new. So if you make a mistake, don't be too proud. Get a new ballot. If you have a voter verified paper audit trail, look at it. They did a study in Nevada in 2004, and only about 30% of voters, the ones that they measured, bothered to ever look at this piece of paper that's running next to the voting machine. Well, you know, this is an important piece of the process, is that you need to make sure that the piece of paper matches up with the electronic total, because there's a chance, if there's a recount, the piece of paper is the only vote that matters. So make sure that it worked correctly. And I think if Cuyahoga County voters paid closer attention, they probably would have noticed these blank spots or other problems with their voter verified paper audit trails. The next step in the process, on the wall of every polling place in the country, is a voter grievance procedure phone number and other information, where if someone has a problem that they feel they were wrongly denied the right to vote, that a machine didn't work, or some other problem, every state has had to establish a formal grievance procedure as part of the Help America Vote Act that was passed in 2002. So that's sort of the last step. And then usually in these high-stakes states and high-stakes races, if you walk outside, you'll see someone wearing a T-shirt that says election protection. If you have a problem, call this number. So there are organizations out there, nonpartisan organizations, that will help voters if they need it.
Well, Dan Seligson, thanks so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. A pleasure.
Dan Seligson is the editor of electionline.org. They've published a 2006 election preview. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start November 6th at capella.edu. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with two leaders of the NAACP, Marvin Doc Cheatham and Reverend Nelson B. Rivers III, about how they're preparing to deal with problems at the polls next Tuesday. Also, Don Byron plays Shotgun and lesser-known tunes by Junior Walker. We talk to the clarinetist, saxophonist, and composer about his new CD, Do the Boomerang. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Voting experts say that problems at the polls in 2000 and 2004 have led to increasing disillusionment among African Americans. The NAACP is encouraging African Americans to vote, and the group is preparing to monitor irregularities and intimidation at the polls. They'll pay special attention to 10 states the group considers likely to have problems. My guests are Reverend Nelson B. Rivers III, the COO of the NAACP, and Marvin Doc Cheatham, president of the NAACP's Baltimore branch. He's overseeing the effort to monitor polls in Baltimore. Maryland is one of the 10 states the NAACP is focusing on. The others are Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Michigan, Mississippi, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas. According to a recent Pew Research Center poll, almost one-third of African Americans today have little or no confidence in the voting system, and more than three times as many African Americans than whites don't think their vote will be accurately counted. Do you sense the distrust that that Pew Research Center poll measured?
Well, absolutely. It's palatable. We can feel it. We hear it. As we move around the country, I do a lot of speaking to NAACP branches and youth units all across America. I just came back from Topeka, Kansas a few days ago, as well as Oakland, California. And everywhere I go, there's this combination of commitment to turn out the vote and to have folk participate in the process, but also acknowledging, even within our own ranks, so much pessimism and suspicion about the process. The Diebold machines generate a lot of suspicion because of the statements of the owner of the company and what happened in Ohio. So there is great suspicion across our community, I think. But I think this year it's balanced with a lot of angst about public policy, a lot of distrust of folk in government, especially the members of Congress now. I think people are going to be motivated to participate slightly higher rates than in the last midterm election. But there is a lot of pessimism, distrust, and antagonism toward the election process.
Dr. Cheatham, what are you hearing?
Well, in the state of Maryland, not only are we hearing, but we've already experienced double requests for absentee ballots as opposed to people physically going to the polls. So it has already shown itself in the fact that all of the voters who normally would have voted for the going into the voting machine, a significant number, double this year, have actually requested the paper ballot.
Because they don't trust the machines.
They don't trust the machines, unfortunately.
And why don't they trust the machines? What's going on in Maryland this year that makes the machines particularly controversial?
Our primary election back in September, we had not a good state election. We had polling places in one county that were not delivered the total part of the apparatus needed to deal with the check-in system. We had a significant number of judges that either had problems with the machine or, in fact, physically were not there. So we had a combination of challenges with the two electronic apparatuses we have in Maryland, coupled with the fact that a significant number of judges did not appear.
Because of questions surrounding the voting machines in Maryland, the governor, who's Republican, is recommending that people vote with absentee ballots. What impact do you think that's having on voters? Can you tell?
The impact is that many people will be voting via absentee ballot when, in fact, they've not done it before. We strongly suggest that they be very careful, that they make certain they vote in every category that they deem appropriate. But we don't totally support that whole concept of absentee ballots. The reason for that is a significant number of voters that vote absentee ballot, believe it or not, I won't say a significant, but at least a number of those, will not have their ballots counted because they didn't follow the process correctly. It's the same situation with provisional ballots. A number of people vote provisional ballots, but the overwhelming majority of provisional ballots are never counted.
So you're not recommending the absentee ballots?
We're recommending folks, at least in the city of Baltimore, and I would say possibly the state of Maryland, if you physically have the ability to get to the polls, go to the polling place where you've been registered.
Have you found that there have been rumors or even conspiracy theories about what to expect this election? Are there rumors and conspiracy theories that are circulating?
Some of this is not theory. Some of it is fact. Some of it is voter suppression tactics that have been used across the years, going back as far as in Arizona when over 30 years ago they used to threaten Hispanic voters with deportation if they showed up. Right now, in many states, we've heard reports in Texas and other places that folk have been threatened that if they show up and are not documented or they'll be checked, that they could be sent back. We also have in Georgia, rumors are out that they're going to, if you come and you have a parking ticket, you'll be arrested, that your records will be checked. all of this is false, but this is a really a tactic that's been going on, tactics that have been used over the years. I've encountered them in almost every election. In my adult experience, I've been working with elections now going back almost 30 years, and I've never been through one that didn't have some kind of trickery, someone trying to manipulate folk, trying to intimidate folk, harass people. Almost always they target people of color, the poor. And so these are not just rumors. This is a fact. We have received samples in the past of postcards that were sent to black voters telling them if you did not pay your child support, you can't vote, telling them that if you did not, if you have a court date outstanding, you'll be arrested on the spot. And we've seen these things, and we know that they exist, and they will exist this time. And so every time in election, we have to have a way to turn the vote out to compensate for the vote that's intimidated or harassed.
How did the elections in 2000 and 2004 affect the way that the NAACP is monitoring elections now in 2006 and affect what it is that you're looking for?
Well, if you recall, in 2000, the NAACP was the first organization to hold hearings and respond with a fact-based response. The hearings revealed to us widespread and amazing problems, intimidation, harassment, and classic failure on the part of the election machinery and the election officials in Florida and then across the country, which led to the implementation or the passage of the HAVA, Help America Vote Act. In fact, a lot of the data that helped the act become law came out of those hearings. And what we learned across the country is that, one, we were very effective in turnout. It was the largest turnout in a number of years and in many places historic voter turnout, especially among black voters. Well, historic turnout also produced historic discrimination, historic harassment, and breakdown in the system. And so we came back in 2002 and found that many of the problems still existed. 2004, another high turnout. We also found, like in Ohio, where they tried to manipulate the process right before the election about who could actually vote, how you register, even down to the size of the paper that you use to register with by mail. A lot of problems with mail-in registration. And so because of that, we developed like a protocol, a criteria that we use to train our folk to have them prepared. We also realized that at the polling place, the long lines, the waits, discourage folk. And some of that turned out in our investigation to be intentional. We think that that was designed to frustrate folk and to have them turn away before they could vote. So a big part of it was to encourage folk to stay in line. No matter how long it takes, you must vote, because only when you vote do you get a chance for your vote to count. Then there's the issue of, even after I vote, will my vote be counted? And so we expect that 2006 is a dry run for us for 2008. In addition to how important these elections are, we're also going to find that which systems still do not work. So we'll have two more years to try to get it right.
Doc Cheatham, what do you think?
One of the things I would like to point out, I've spent almost all of my life in the field of elections. From the 2000 election, we did not learn and did not listen to those of us that are considered to be election experts. And I'm still crying out today. What we need is a computerized voting system that is transparent, that enables you to have a paper trail and a paper receipt. And you can't tell me that with all of the technological institutions we have across the country, including Morgan State University here in the great state of Maryland, that we cannot, in fact, build the type of apparatus that we've been crying out for since the year 2000. We can go to the moon. You can't tell me we can't build a machine. It has to be a transparent, computerized machine, paper trail, paper receipt.
Doc Cheatham, you have been focusing on elections for many years. Do you feel like progress has been made in fairness and getting African Americans access to polls in your lifetime? Would you feel like we're heading back in the wrong direction?
Sadly enough, I think we're heading in the wrong direction. I think, sadly enough, a number of people have found more ways to disenfranchise both poor and people of color. And I think it just makes our resolve with the NAACP that much stronger, that we must fight even harder, because the discriminations and the racism that took place years ago may not be the same that we're experiencing today. It's more sophisticated, which means we must become more talented in fighting those that have ill will with the election process. And I'm discouraged, but not to the point that I will give up. We will continue fighting to make certain that every vote counts, no matter where we are in the country.
Well, thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, and God bless you.
It's been a pleasure.
Nelson B. Rivers III is the COO of the NAACP. Marvin Doc Cheatham is the president of the NAACP's Baltimore branch. If you're wondering if he's related to the late trumpeter Doc Cheatham, yes, he's a great-nephew. Coming up, we talk with Don Byron. His new CD pays tribute to Junior Walker. This is Fresh Air. When clarinetist and saxophonist Don Byron puts together a new concert or CD, I'm always curious to see what he's up to. He's a terrific composer, but he often performs music of composers he loves, and his choices represent a wonderful mix of styles. Klezmer, Earth, Wind & Fire, The Sugar Hill Gang, Henry Mancini, Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, Sly Stone, Lester Young, and Duke Ellington are just some examples. His new CD, Do the Boomerang, features tunes written or recorded by the saxophonist Junior Walker, including Walker's 1969 hit, What Does It Take?, and his first hit, Shotgun, from 1965. Here's Don Byron's band, with Dean Bowman doing the vocal. Don Byron, welcome back to Fresh Air. So why did you want to do an album of Junior Walker tunes?
I had always been a fan of Junior Walker's music, and I had never really had any way of really understanding it other than I liked it. And quite a few years ago, as I was moving through various phases, I discovered Black gospel religion and culture, and found that a lot of the music that had happened in the 20th century was pretty much coming out of that. And in my exploration, I kind of figured out where he was coming from, that a lot of the mannerisms that he was using, if you want to call them mannerisms, were really gospelisms, and they came out of the singing and preaching of the Black church.
What else do you hear in his playing or in his tunes that you didn't hear when you were younger?
Well, I think that's mostly it. It's kind of a vocal quality instead of doing what horn players are taught, which is studying other horn players. And I think as an American horn player, you're either in school a classical musician or a jazz musician. And when we're talking about jazz, we're talking about melodic material where the chords and the scales are kind of matched up and the melodies come out of the scales that are associated with the chords. What I could hear was another way of relating that was much more the way an R&B vocalist tends to relate to singing a song and improvising on and around the melody of it.
It's interesting. Like Junior Walker had like several dance hits, you know, like Do the Boomerang and of course Shotgun. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you not too long ago were doing a show of early like Sugar Hill hip hop and rap records, which are also kind of like party music, but mm-hmm. it's completely it's like two different generations. Do you think a lot about how for a lot of people music is purely generational? It's about what they grew up with as opposed to kind of listening to the music of many generations.
Well, I think as a musician, you don't think as much about, you know, generational difference as much as you think about stylistic difference. And I think the whole aspect of Junior Walker's music coming from gospel was something that was really new for me. About, I don't know how long ago it was, maybe 10 years ago, I started really paying attention to gospel music, first through checking out gospel preachers. And there was a group of them, Jasper Williams from Atlanta, William Ellis from Chicago, Paul Morton from New Orleans, that I checked out that I thought even just speaking, I could hear the beginnings of gospel singing coming directly from these preachers. There's just a real connection within gospel culture, and even more now, the current gospel culture, you see the preaching alongside with the singing, alongside with the instrumental playing, like it's all kind of one piece. And as I was checking this stuff out and really, you know, believe it or not, discovering Jesus for myself, I started to see these connections. And as it was working its way through me, all of a sudden, man, I understand what this music is coming from. It really got into me.
So did I hear you correctly? Are you saying that through investigating gospel music and preachers that you ended up becoming Christian?
Yeah. I mean, I was Christian all along in the kind of way that, you know, somebody that's Catholic and doesn't go to church is Catholic and doesn't go to church. I was a Lutheran and didn't go to church. And the kind of church that I went to was, well, we had a British minister at my church in the South Bronx. In fact, I'm completely convinced that the guy was convinced that he was doing missionary work by ministering to us in the South Bronx. But, you know, the music wasn't really funky. It wasn't really coming out of this. In fact, you know, this kind of church culture was not what I was exposed to. But I will correct you that I think it was the preaching that I was checking out first. I was just in a period where some things that I was working on business-wise and didn't work out, and I was a little down about it. And then I started checking these guys out and what they were saying. It was like they were like this black rooting section for me. I felt like they were talking to me. They seemed to understand my situation in a certain kind of way that I had never really experienced in my church-going experience. I was like, wow, where was this? You know, if I had known some of this stuff, I could have gotten through a lot more of the things that I went through with a lot more confidence. And then I discovered the music. It was kind of the other way around. So it was really, you know, when I say these guys kind of transformed my life, it wasn't so much that I checked out some music on an intellectual vibe and then I got a little Jesus. It was like the Jesus kind of came first.
So do you think of yourself as born again now?
I think of myself as kind of gussied up. No, not necessarily born again, just a little gussied up. I'm just a little gussied up, I think is the right word. I'm gussied up for Jesus, you know?
My guest is Don Byron. His new CD is called Do the Boomerang, the music of Junior Walker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ My guest is saxophonist, clarinetist, and composer Don Byron. His new CD, Do the Boomerang, features the music of Junior Walker. This is the track Mark Anthony Speaks. George Colligan is featured on the Hammond B3 organ. Interesting quote by you. You said that you think of yourself as having been influenced by Lee Strasberg, the great actor who was also famous for teaching the method. And mm-hmm. and you said that it gave you the idea that you could change yourself musically the way an actor changes for different roles. And I was wondering how deep that change goes. I mean, when you change yourself musically, is mm-hmm. it just the music that's changing, or are you changing other things, like in a performance? Do you behave differently on stage? Do you dress differently? And when you're home working through different periods or different styles of music, do you find your own personality changing during that period?
Wow. That's yet another super provocative question of yours. I would say, for the most part, no. But in this particular case, you know, getting to a place where I could play Junior Walker's music meant really dealing with gospel blues in a way that was very personal. I don't think I could have gotten to this music without embracing some of the boundless hope of gospel music. And I think to do this project, I had to have some kind of epiphany about the structure of my religious beliefs. And in that way, it's a much bigger change than playing, say, klezmer music, where, there was never any kind of feeling when I was playing klezmer music that I wasn't like the same person, like a Christian person from the Bronx. But then, as I said, the whole mentality around embracing this culture is a big change for me. It's also a big change for me trying to be more positive. trying to be more positive is a big change for a person like me. You know, like, my thing is, dark to very dark.
But there's a real darkness to Junior Walker's music, which I don't think I noticed until I was listening to you and then going back and listening to him again. I didn't notice that mm-hmm. in the 60s when I was listening to him.
Yeah, I think I think the best word I would say is smoky.
Uh-huh.
It's a little smoky tinge to everything. It's and a lot of it is associations we have with the kind of sound on those records, the instruments, like he often has organ on his records, which a lot of Motown records don't have organ. They have piano. The organ is much more of an atmospheric kind of thing, but there's a kind of sadness, kind of bluesy sadness, and a kind of smoky laid-backness to some of the music. Certainly a piece like Cleo's Mood really has that very heavily.
Anything else you want to tell us about Junior Walker and why you like his music so much?
Well, I think when we're talking about horn players who have this kind of gospel blues heavy influence, the ones that people remember are a lot of the ones that are attached to the big vocalists of a period. So with Ray Charles, we've got Hank Crawford and Fathead Newman. With James Brown, there's Maceo Parker and Fred Wesley. With Aretha, there's King Curtis. And, that kind of interplay that I was talking about before between a soloist and a singer, you really feel that when Maceo's in there. James Brown is alive. He's like happy to hear how Maceo is taking what he sung and converted it into his own version of that language. And I think what's amazing about Junior Walker is he is actually his own singer inspiration.
Well, Don Byron, great to talk with you again. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Don Byron's new CD is Do the Boomerang, the music of Junior Walker. Some of Byron's own compositions are featured on the latest Bang on a Can CD, A Ballad for Many. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Vertigo, a novel of suspense set in Victorian England by Lauren Baratz Logstead. From the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. And from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the really funny NBC series The Office with its executive producer Greg Daniels, who also writes and directs for the show, and Mindy Kaling, who wrote this week's episode and plays Kelly Kapoor. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.